Hi, folks. It's Denise Howell. And next up on This Week in Law, Joe Mornin, who is a Forbes 30 Under 30 honoree, a software engineer and a lawyer, joins us to talk about a number of interesting projects he's got going on. We're going to discuss brony fonts, photogenic farm animals and pets, doppelganger takedowns, and much more next on This Week in Law.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for This Week in Law is provided by CashFly at CacheFly.com.
This is TWiL, This Week in Law with Denise Howell and Emery Roan. Episode 335, recorded February 5th, 2016. Lawyers in Latex. This episode of This Week in Law is brought to you by the Ring Video Doorbell. With Ring, you can see and talk to anyone at your door from anywhere in the world using your smartphone. It's like caller ID for your home. Right now, get free expedited FedEx shipping when you go to ring.com/twill. And by PillPack, a full-service pharmacy that combines personalized service, convenient packaging, and modern technology to make your life easier. Visit pillpack.com/twit to save $20 on vitamins and OTCs when you transfer your prescriptions. Hi, folks. Denise Howell here, and you're joining us for This Week in Law. I'm so excited that you've joined us again this week. I'm here with my co-host, Emery Roan. Hello, Emery.
Hello, Denise. As always, thanks for having me. It's great to be here.
Wonderful to see you again. We have a really interesting and exciting guest who's going to join us for the first part of the show. He's Joe Mornin. He's a software engineer and a lawyer at Winston & Strawn in San Francisco. Such an interesting guy. He was recently put on the Forbes 30 Under 30 list in law and policy. He's a fellow at the Stanford Law School Center for Legal Informatics and a legal hacker in his own right, with a bunch of projects, open source projects and otherwise, that he has come up with over the years in his capacity as both a software engineer and lawyer. Things that help the public in some instances, things that help the legal profession in others. So, Joe, it's really great to have you on the show.
Thanks for having me.
So tell us about your background a bit. I see you went to Reed College, and I cannot help but think of you treading the same paths that Steve Jobs did once upon a time. Does his persona sort of hang over the Reed campus like a cloak?
A little bit, yeah. We like to claim Steve Jobs, even though he didn't end up graduating, he still hung around and sort of
right.
gave us some of his aura, I guess.
The fame, yes, he was famous for hanging around Reed College. So you were an English lit major there, which I relate to. That's what my undergrad major was as well. When did you sort of flip the switch in your brain to get interested in coding and technology?
It was actually way before college. I just sort of taught myself how to code as a kid. I had a computer and just started playing around with it and learned to code early on back in the Netscape and AOL days, and have just kind mm-hmm. of been building since.
Yeah, and at one point along your path, you were a research assistant to Professor Lawrence Lessig. How did that happen?
Yeah, that's right. So I was working at a place called the Berkman Center for Internet and Society, which was run out of the Harvard Law School, and Lessig was one of the sort of early figures founding that center. So when I was working there, Lessig came back to Harvard, and he had sort of just made the switch from working on copyright reform to money and politics reform. And he was looking for someone that sort of had the skill set of both programming and sort of tech savviness, and also kind of political awareness and interest in money and politics and campaign finance issues. And he needed someone to sort of help run the online organizing campaigns for his reform projects. And he'd been a huge inspiration for me in thinking about law and technology, and the opportunity to work with him was too good to pass up. So I went for it.
Right. And while you were working with him, you developed some of the tools that were involved in his policy campaigns of late of getting money out of politics. You built the tech and led campaigns for both Root Strikers and Represent.us. Can you tell us a bit about that?
Yeah, so he's been involved in a series of kind of entrepreneurial nonprofit projects, from Change Congress in the early days through Fix Congress First through Root Strikers and affiliated projects like Represent Us. And I've been sort of managing the tech infrastructure for a lot of those projects and combining that with online organizing. So it's been a sort of combination of digital campaigning and running infrastructure and sort of smaller micro projects sort of around specific initiatives.
Right. It's too bad that he had to bow out of the presidential campaign. About the most high profile exposure I saw him get during the campaign was his appearance on the Bill Maher show, where Bill Maher was upset, and so was he, that he hadn't been involved in or invited to participate in the first Democratic candidate debate. But it seems like Bernie Sanders has sort of taken up the mantle of money out of politics in his stead.
Yeah, it's a shame that Lessig had to end his campaign so early, because he qualified. He met the qualifications to enter the Democratic debates. They sort of changed the rules on him and pulled the rug out from under him. So he didn't get a chance to get his voice on the national platform, which I think was... I think a lot of his supporters ended up being sort of disappointed in the Democratic Party establishment because of that. But you're right, Bernie Sanders has made it sort of a cornerstone of his campaign. A lot of the same issues involving money in politics and ending corruption and that sort of systemic reform.
Right. Well, and you've worked at places where we frequently mine for guests for the show, the Electronic Frontier Foundation and the Center for Democracy and Technology. Can you tell us what you were involved in there?
Yeah, so those were sort of my law school internship experiences. At the Center for Democracy and Technology, I worked on reforms to the Electronic Communications Privacy Act, and I also worked on Fourth Amendment privacy issues there. At EFF, I worked on projects that were more focused on intellectual property. I worked on patent troll reform, and I worked on some copyright issues involving liability for ISPs and other web service providers, things like that.
So I love this too. You're going along, you're doing all these projects. At what point in the discussion we've just had of your background, you were going to law school when you worked at the EFF and Center for Democracy and Technology. Did you go to law school right out of Reed?
No, I spent a couple of years working at the Berkman Center, and that's sort of what led to the decision to do law school.
Yes, that's a great place to decide whether or not this is for you. And I really admire that you took the time to make that decision. I was just overhearing a woman on the sidewalk next to me the other day talking about how she went to law school and knew early on how much she hated it and couldn't wait to get out of the profession once she graduated. And I think that that's, you know, such a common story.
It is common. I knew people who lasted maybe a semester and then left. But I mean, it's so expensive that once you've spent a year in law school, I mean, you're already $50,000 in debt at least. So you sort of have to stick around in order to get the degree so you can pay it off.
Right. And I think it's really admirable to find a way to make the law your own, which it really seems like you have done in pursuing various projects where, you know, you've done what the classic innovator does. You find areas where something's amiss, it's bugging you, and you step in and decide to code a fix. Can you tell us about some of those projects you've worked on?
Yeah, so one of my main law school projects is a project called Best Law. It's at the URL is bestlaw.io. So the origin of that project is that almost every law student and lawyer in America has to do legal research on one of two platforms, Lexis and Westlaw. They essentially control the legal research market in the U.S., and that's because they're the ones who have access to the primary source legal information, primarily case law. So you have to use these platforms if you want to be a law student or lawyer in the U.S. These platforms are good. I think they do a great job of collecting information and organizing it in kind of a sensible way. But in terms of the tools that they give researchers and lawyers to manipulate the information and sort of explore it, the interfaces are in many ways kind of stuck in the web 1.0 days. So there are a lot of things about using these tools that just bugged me. I knew that they could be better in a lot of ways. So I just started coding fixes just on my own computer to make life easier for me. And gradually those started, I started collecting more and more features, and eventually sort of dawned on me that other people would find these useful as well. So that's when I decided to turn it into sort of a public facing project. It's things like Blue Book citations, right? The Blue Book has these insanely complicated rules for how citations are supposed to be structured. And you have to sort of flip through these hundreds and hundreds of pages in order to find the rules for the type of citation that you're trying to write. I knew that that could be automated because the rules are there and the information is there. So I just built a feature to let you generate the citation with one click, things like that.
That's wonderful. Thank you. As a law student, thank you. Thank you so much.
Yeah. Tell us more. I was telling Emery before the show, I've been a practicing lawyer now for more years than I can count. I graduated in 1990, so everyone could do the math there. But I haven't used Westlaw or Lexis. I haven't litigated in a while. Yeah. I'm doing more IP and communications consulting for people. So I haven't needed to thoroughly do the kind of research that you use Westlaw and Lexis for in quite some time, where you're double checking the validity of case law and that kind of thing, where yeah. you're needing to precisely make sure that your citation format is exactly what the court needs and requires that. So it's been a while, and it doesn't surprise me that Westlaw and Lexis are still using more of a Web 1.0 interface. I was telling Emery before the show that Westlaw and Lexis existed when I was going to law school and before that. And so, you know, well before most people were using the internet the way we're so used to using it now. And also well before other services became available, that in large part, you know, if you don't need those specific precise features, it's very possible, and I see that you worked at publicresource.org as well, yes. to find the law without using Westlaw and Lexis. So that being said, how does Bestlaw work exactly? It complements Westlaw and Lexis, both of them?
Yeah, that's right. So it lives on top of both Lexis and Westlaw. Mm-hmm. It's an app that lives inside your browser. So every time you browse to a page on Westlaw or a page on Lexis, it'll actually add features directly into those interfaces. And so it'll add like a menu above the document that you're reading with a bunch of options to manipulate the page that you're currently viewing. Yeah, you right. can sort of see it in that screenshot there.
There we go. Go ahead. Emery.
So I was just curious if you ran into any issues regarding IP working. I know that Westlaw and Lexis are very, very protective of the ways that you can handle their documents. They track when you yeah. download and your user information and everything. Did you run into any issues when you were coding this? Or I know that the Bestlaw Pro, for example, allows you to have free downloads. Is that how does that work against their terms of use?
Yeah, so the way it works is that you can find a lot of the documents on Westlaw elsewhere on the web, like Denise was just saying. A lot of, not all, but a lot of primary case law is available on sites like public.resource.org or Google Scholar or Case Texts. So the information's there. The hard part is being able to find it. That's really the value of platforms like Lexis and Westlaw. They're the ones that have a comprehensive database of legal information, and they have the tools that lawyers are familiar with to be able to manipulate that information and find it. But the problem often, like you said, is that because there's such a lack of innovation and competition in the legal research space, these platforms can do things like charge you often dozens of dollars to download one of these documents that's available elsewhere on the web. So one of the features that Bestlaw Pro offers is once you've found a document on, say, Westlaw, Bestlaw will then find it on one of these free resources and package it for you in kind of like a nicely downloadable and readable PDF, so you can get that download or that printout without having to pay another charge.
That's brilliant. That's awesome. That's what I was hoping for. I love that.
Yeah, it's a brilliant idea. Has Westlaw ever hassled you about the name?
No, they have not.
That's good. It seems like that might be something that might happen at some point, especially you have a pro component that's for pay, correct?
That's right. It's $5 a month for the feature I just talked about and some others.
Right. Well, hopefully you're sufficiently under the radar. Tell us about some of your other projects, because Fluff Blocker also looks quite interesting.
Yeah, Fluff Blocker was just, I actually just coded that up in an afternoon, just sort of like as a hobby side project. It has nothing to do with law directly. So The problem that that's trying to solve is that, like a lot of people, I spend a lot of time on Facebook. I probably spend time on Facebook when maybe I should be spending time, I don't know, reading NPR or New York Times or something, being more virtuous about my news consumption. But no, I spend a lot of time on Facebook. And if you use the desktop version, you see the trending topics in the right-hand column. And a lot of the news that shows up in the trending topics is not always the most newsworthy stuff. It's often really entertaining, and it's often really enticing. There's some examples in the screenshot there, like study finds pizza to be the most addictive food. Like, okay, that's interesting. I mean, I'm glad the U.S. government is tackling the hard problems, but it's not really the kind of like news diet that I want to be exposed to. And since I'm addicted to Facebook and spend a lot of time there, I thought, wouldn't it be great if I could get some more substantive news sort of sitting there in that column while I'm browsing through my newsfeed? So Fluff Blocker does is take those Facebook trending topics and replace them with news headlines from the New York Times or NPR or The Guardian or any RSS feed that you want to plug in.
That's brilliant as well. What a wonderful thing. And I'm going to have to download that forthwith. Here is something that is an ongoing issue for the legal profession that, again, you've jumped in and helped tackle the problem. It's something that even, you know, the members of the Supreme Court are thinking about. And that is the fact that as more and more of our resources and scholarly evidence of our thoughts and reasoning go online, there's less of an ability to reliably know that something that was cited in a 2015 decision from the Supreme Court, for example, is going to persist into the future when people might want to refer to it. So tell us about perma.cc.
Yeah, so it turns out this is actually a really urgent problem. So in the internet age, in court opinions and legal scholarship, authors and judges are citing to internet resources, right? They're dropping URLs into their opinions and their law review articles. And because it's the internet and it's often kind of transient and ephemeral, these links break. The pages that the URLs point to just go away, go offline, point to other things. It turns out that 50% of links in Supreme Court opinions are just dead. They point nowhere. 70% of links in Harvard Law Review articles point nowhere. So it's this huge problem if you're interested in preserving the authority that these citations are relying on. I mean, the citation's no good if the authority that you're citing to doesn't exist anymore or doesn't exist at the address that you've given. So the project that I built to solve that, it's a pretty simple idea. The idea is that if you're an author or, say, a judge writing a court opinion and you want to cite to a URL, you would use this tool to plug the URL in, and then it would generate sort of a backup copy of that page. So then you could cite to the URL, and then you could also cite to the backup copy in case the original URL goes offline. So that's all it does. I built that during my first year in law school, and then it turned out that the Harvard Law Library was really interested in solving this problem as well, and I sort of knew people there from working at the Berkman Center and working with Lessig. So we decided to team up. They acquired the code that I built, and then I helped them build this out into the platform that's now known as perma.cc.
That's so interesting. Digital archiving is such a tough problem. I think Steve and Leo were talking about it just last week on Security Now. I had never even considered this aspect of digital archiving. This is that our court opinions are based on these authorities that are now just disappearing because it's hard to do this. It's a great project.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Are there IP issues that you and then Harvard ran into in building out perma.cc in that some of the cited resources obviously aren't public records, but private copyrighted material? So in creating an archive, were you running into Google Books kinds of issues?
Yeah, I mean, this is a problem for any digital archiving project. I mean, this is a big problem that the Internet Archive is facing also, because you're right. I mean, this material is generally copyrighted and we're making copies of it, and that's potentially an infringement of the reproduction right. One of the nice things about working with the Harvard Law Library is that this is sort of now their problem and not my problem.
Yeah. and a good person to have the problem.
Yeah. But it is something that the project is really sensitive to. For instance, the project respects the robots.txt directives that sites put up. So sites can use what's called a robots.txt file to prevent their site from getting like indexed by search engines or crawled by other types of crawlers. So if someone tries to archive a page using PERMA and the site owner has indicated that they don't want their page to be archived in this manner, PERMA will respect that. I think that goes a long way to solving some of the copyright issues in sort of a private ordering sort of way without being litigious about it. And also, this is not something that I've been involved in lately, but there are Digital Millennium Copyright Act issues, and this is a service that if the authors whose sites are being archived have concerns, the DMCA sets out procedures for the site owner to address that. So that's another aspect of this.
Indeed. And we're going to talk about some DMCA takedown fun with the DMCA later on in the show for sure. Let's talk about one other of your projects, Latex for Lawyers. And no, it's not what you're all thinking. Get your minds out of the latex gutter. We were talking about how access to legal records is more and more something that is available freely and from many sources. But access to legal forms is a little bit more problematic. So tell us what Latex for Lawyers does about that.
Yeah, so one of my pet peeves, not just in law, although especially in law, is that we're so reliant on proprietary tools like Microsoft Word and Adobe's PDF format. And it's not just the fact that these are proprietary formats that bugs me. What bugs me is that they are incredibly hard for computers to manipulate. A Microsoft Word file just can't be sliced and diced in interesting ways using code that other types of information can, say if it's like plain text or HTML or XML.
Right.
And that's a big constraint in the legal innovation space, because a lot of the innovation is centered around manipulating the text in legal documents. And it's really, really hard to do that when the text is locked up in PDF files or Microsoft Word files. So LaTeX, it's pronounced either LaTeX or LaTeX, even though it's spelled latex, it's kind of a good way to describe it is a document processing system. It's essentially a way to structure documents that lets you essentially write code in plain text so that the documents are really, really easy to manipulate. If you want to do things like automating the writing of contracts, or if you want to extract information from a court opinion, if the document is written in LaTeX, it's much, much easier to do that. So it turns out that there's a small merry band of geeky lawyers who are interested in this same kind of thing. So we just sort of have an informal community, and we're trying to push for getting legal documents to be created in these formats that are easy for machines to manipulate, because we think that's going to lead to a lot more innovation in legal technology.
So how would that work in a law practice? Would you be automatically generating the LaTeX document alongside a Word document and a PDF?
Yeah, that's right. So it's really easy to automatically generate a LaTeX document, because it's essentially just plain text with certain commands to indicate certain things like bold text or a paragraph break, things like that. That's incredibly hard to automatically generate a Microsoft Word document in Word. But once you've generated the LaTeX document using whatever program you might use to do that, then it's pretty trivial to convert that to a Word document or PDF.
I think that machine-readable contracts and machine-readable privacy policies and documents are the most noble, excellent plan for tackling this problem. Whether it's smart contracts or LaTeX, I think that this is just such an incredible project. Do you have any – is anyone working with LaTeX to make machine-readable privacy policies, for example, that may give users better notice or any other cool applications of LaTeX that we should talk about?
Not that I know of, and I think the reason for that is that if you're, say, a company that's implementing a privacy policy, you want to be transparent to a certain point, but it's that there's sort of this perverse incentive where you don't want to make your privacy policy too easy to understand.
Mm-hmm.
So
I think it's the problem.
Kind of projects, there are projects on the other side of the equation that are looking at privacy policies around the web and almost sort of reverse engineering them to make them easier to understand.
Absolutely. Yeah, I've seen a couple projects that are looking at using browser plugins to, rather than making the contracts machine readable, just teach the machines to read the contracts. I've seen some proposals for plugins that may like analyze privacy policies and give icons or privacy notices to users, which this sounds like it would work really concurrently, would work really well together.
Yeah, exactly. Those projects are fantastic. So the part of the problem that I'm trying to solve is, how do we get those documents to be machine readable when they're created in the first place?
So how can someone that's interested in this work on this project? Or is there a place where we should – how can I get into the team? That's what I want to know.
So there's a link on my website at mornin.org, and there's a box there for the LaTeX for Lawyers project. So you can sign up there.
Great.
I'm interested in what you guys are discussing, this whole notion of making the machines more able to read the document and interpret what the document means and spit it out in simplified language for the user. But don't you think that's kind of fraught with trouble and potential trouble for, misinterpreting or giving someone the wrong impression of what the document actually says?
Yeah, well, I think there's a way to thread the needle. Right. I mean, we're so far from having contracts and like user license agreements that humans can understand. I mean, it's the biggest joke in Silicon Valley that nobody ever reads the iTunes license agreement. I mean, it's like Finnegan's Wake. It's like fundamentally unreadable. So, I mean, I think anything that can make that more intelligible to an actual human is a step in the right direction. I mean, I think I understand the concern that you're getting at. I mean, you can't have machines that are spitting out text that replaces the contract, right? Because the contract still has to be a legal document with legal effect.
Right.
But I think there is a way to help assist human readers in making sense of it.
Yes, there should be a way to at least make the situation better than it is without, I worry that the well-minded coders such as yourselves who might delve into this fraught field might be in for some problematic pushback because, we relied on what we were told by our browser add-on and it turns out not to accurately reflect what I was bound to by this thing I clicked on.
I think that's going to happen. I think I think that software assistance is coming down the pike in some form or another. And it's probably going to happen at some point that someone's going to rely to their detriment on bad advice given to them by software. And then it will be a very interesting legal battle.
I'm
right there with Joe. I think that this is something that, if we're talking about concerns about consumers being misinformed by policy. So that's clearly already happening right now. We just had to talk about our monster cat discussion 2 weeks ago to, even when the terms are presented to a user in user-friendly or plain English terms necessarily, that doesn't mean that this can't still be misrepresented to them.
Yeah, I totally agree. I think a lot of it, especially in the privacy context, comes down to consent and choice. I think right now privacy policies are often so dense that if you're a lawyer, you can understand what they mean. But if you're just an ordinary user, you might not be able to understand, based on the privacy policy, how a site that you're visiting or logging into is tracking your activity or using or selling your data, for instance. I think these kind of projects go a long way to making those sorts of activities more transparent to the users. So maybe not to the extent that the user would try and rely on that to enforce a legal right, but at least it helps the user understand and agree to what the site is doing. It helps give the user more autonomy, I think.
Yeah.
Well, you're a busy lawyer as well as being a busy coder, so I'm not going to put too much on your side project plate, Joe, but talking about tracking with your consent or without your consent, I'm wondering if you've ever seen a project like the ones we've talked about already that you've worked on that deals with the metadata that goes into URIs. So I'm noticing that whenever I generate a link to share whatever it is, whether it's a web page or a piece of media online, and I want to either post it or send it to someone so they can check it out, there's always something that's tacked on that tells the owner of the content how you came to them. It's all sorts of information for them. You know, how are we doing in our marketing, basically? You know, is this working? Is that working? And I always strip it out. I'm constantly thwarting those folks' efforts manually. So have you ever seen somebody put together something that would do that for you?
No, it's funny you mentioned that. I've thought about building that very project.
Good.
I know exactly the problem you're talking about. I think that the big barrier, the thing that makes it kind of a non-trivial project to build, is that it's hard in an automated way to know which parts of the URL are used for tracking and which parts of the URL are actually used to retrieve information. Because you need to be able to design a program that will strip out the parts used for tracking but not touch the parts that are actually used to look up the address of the page that you're trying to get to.
Right.
And there's no standard for that sort of tracking information. There are some patterns that are sometimes commonly used.
Question marks seem to be key. Everything after the question mark, including the question mark, can usually go.
That's right. If you want to get geeky about it, there's a thing called query string that starts with the question mark. And then anything after that is known as the query string. It'll be like question mark source equals Facebook, and then you'll see an ampersand and then another variable and another value. So yeah, it's true that you can use that to sort of append metadata to a URL. The problem with that is that sites often misuse that, or depending on your perspective, abuse that. Sometimes the information in that query string is actually used to look up information in a URL. In other words, sometimes if you strip out that entire string of text, you'll actually break the URL in addition to removing the tracking. So it's unfortunately not quite that easy.
Yep. Might not be a perfect system, but something I would certainly use, and I would think other people would be interested in using as well. I think we're going to, since we're having this discussion among a merry band of lawyers of varying geekiness, we'll make merry band of geeky lawyers our first MCLE passphrase for this episode of This Week in Law. We put these phrases into the show in case you are interested in submitting for continuing legal education or other professional education credit. We touch on a lot of interesting and substantive topics here on the show, and we think that certainly they'd be worthwhile for your local oversight board to take a look at. So if you agree, we do have some information for lawyers at wiki.twit.tv. Find our show page there, This Week in Law, and for the 50 jurisdictions in the United States, we've got information on how you could go about submitting for credit for watching or listening to the show. And we put these phrases in case your particular oversight board, and some of them do, want to have some demonstrable proof that you haven't just written this down on a list, but you actually can demonstrate, hey, you know, I know the secret voids. So this is our first one for the show, the merry band of geeky lawyers. many geeky lawyers, at least back in my day, you know, we were still writing out our law school notes and passing them around that way. Photocopying them was about as high tech as we got with this. But I see that you've basically open sourced all your law school notes, Joe. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, it's probably about the geekiest thing that you can do as a law student. All of my notes are on GitHub. GitHub is the place where a lot of open source software lives. The law school classes where I took copious notes, I tried to organize them and stick them up on GitHub. And amazingly, a few people have actually found them and have used them. I've gotten a few emails from law students saying, thanks for doing this. So that's cool.
I will be checking those out after the show, I promise.
Yes, Emery's got a whole other year where that could be useful for him.
Yeah. And closing the loop, they are written in LaTeX. So that can be an introduction to well-structured, gene-readable documents.
Awesome. Yeah, definitely. I will take a look at that.
Yeah.
Do you know of others who've done this, or are you a lone voice in the wilderness, Joe?
I think I might be a lone wolf on this one. There's a lot of sharing of law school notes. I think there are even some sites out there that have schemes where you can pay to download other people's notes, and you can get like credits for uploading your own. I'm forgetting the name of the sites that do that, but there's a cottage industry around selling law school notes. Mine are licensed under Creative Commons license, so go for it.
As they should be.
Nice.
Wonderful.
Well, and this is another situation, though, where you might have other rights holders who come in and say, hey, you know, I provided the content, the substance for those notes that you took, and you're not authorized to reproduce that content. I can't see UC Berkeley, where you went to school, the Bolt Hall School of Law, my alma mater as well, doing that, but you never know.
I think this did happen. I don't know if it actually got litigated, but I remember reading long ago about a case where a professor had accused a student of copyright infringement for publishing notes based on the professor's lectures. And unfortunately, I don't remember any more details than that.
Yeah.
Professor obviously wasn't an IP professor.
No, I think I know some other professors who might be willing to get my back on that. I'm not too worried, but if it happens, I'll give you a call and we can talk it over.
Yeah, we'd love to hear about it if indeed it does. We hope that it doesn't, and that all of your projects continue to crank on, and your law practice as well. Is there anything going on in particular with anything you're working on? The side projects we've discussed, or anything you're involved in that you want to let people know about before we go ahead and let you off the show?
Yeah, I mean, just quickly, I have another project that's going to launch in about a month. It's totally non-law related. It's actually a biotech project, science-focused. We're using crowdsourcing and artificial intelligence in order to analyze scientific images. It turns out this is a huge bottleneck in scientific research. Images are too hard for computers to analyze, but really easy for humans to do. So we're sort of taking expert scientists out of the equation and using crowd workers and machine learning to handle that aspect of scientific research. So that'll be a lot
of fun.
Cool.
Really cool. Do you have a name for it yet?
Yeah, it's called Quantius. It's not public yet, but it should be in a few weeks.
Very nice. And for more on Quantius and everything else we've discussed with Joe today, you can go to mornin.org. He has, as Emery and I were remarking before the show, one of the most beautiful lawyer websites we've ever seen. Just very clean and easy to use and informative. So kudos to you on that as well, Joe. And on your recognition by Forbes, well deserved.
Thank you. Thank you.
Take care and good luck with everything.
Okay, really nice talking with you. Thanks for having me.
Really nice talking with you, too.
See you, Joe.
Emery and I are going to continue on with the show and discuss some more substantive topics here in a moment, including we couldn't do this week's show without talking about the Fine Brothers and React videos. So we'll get to that in just a moment. We're going to first thank our first sponsor for this episode of This Week in Law, and that is the Ring Video Doorbell. Of course, you're all familiar with the sound of a doorbell. It means a package is being delivered or friends are coming over for dinner. But it's also the sound of someone planning to rob you. Of course, your door is your entry point to your castle, whatever that castle may consist of. So it is definitely a good idea to have a more interactive doorbell than the kind that we are used to. And that's where Ring steps in. Over 95% of home break-ins happen during the day, and burglars almost always start by ringing your doorbell to see if someone's home before trying to come on in. And who knows, you know, in your busy day, whether you've remembered to even lock the door. Hopefully you have. But with the Ring video doorbell, when someone rings that doorbell, whether you've locked up or not, you can see and talk to them from anywhere in the world on your smartphone. This is an amazing advancement in doorbell technology. It also it has a motion detection built in. So even if no one has rung your doorbell, if someone comes and leaves off a package, you're going to see that happen. Or if someone comes and is messing about trying your door, you're going to see that as well. You can talk to delivery people and keep an eye on your packages that have been left there. If, you know, oftentimes what happens is something gets delivered to your front door. Oh, that would be my front door we're looking at if you're watching the video. So here is Ring in action at my house. And this was wonderful, this interaction that I had. This was the third attempt by UPS to deliver a package to our house. My husband had ridiculously ordered a package that required a signature. So it couldn't just be dropped off at the front door. And there was no one home at this time to get. There he is, leaving the little sticker telling me, I am not coming back. This is your last delivery. So this is going to our hub and you're going to have to come pick it up, you know, way out of your way. I managed to get him, see him walking back. Calling him back. The Ring let me know because he rang the doorbell, and I was actually able to talk with him and say, hey, you know, no one's home right now. I felt safe telling the UPS guy this. And I know this is your third attempt to deliver. You know, how can I avoid having you take this away so that we have to go somewhere far away to collect it? And he told me, hey, I can leave it with your neighbor across the street if you think they're home. I can try that. And if that doesn't work, I'll tell you where I'm going to be. I have a pickup in an hour and a half at an address near your house. You could meet me there and I'll give it to you there. So I had two ways that I could easily get this package, even though, you know, per his marching orders from UPS, he was supposed to take it away and take it somewhere where it was going to be tough for us to get it. So Ring can come in really handy, not just from a security standpoint, but just in a life management standpoint as well. It's like having a neighbor at your door, keeping an eye on things 24/7. So installing Ring, I found, takes just minutes, and it works with either your current wiring or a built-in rechargeable battery. That's the way I'm using ours. Seems to work great. The battery has not given me the tiniest peep that it needs to be recharged yet. I think they last quite a long time. Put your mind at ease and protect your home with the video doorbell. Time Magazine and USA Today named one of their top 10 gadgets of 2015. Go to ring.com/twill for free expedited FedEx shipping. And I'm sorry, you're not going to be able to, you better be there to sign for it, because until you get that thing installed, you're not going to be able to tell the FedEx guy to come back if he's tried three times. But with Ring, that problem is solved for you, and you are always home. Thank you so much, Ring, for your support of This Week in Law and for your help in managing our doorway. Okay, so we're going to get into some copyright stories next. Well, the Fine Brothers, not to be confused with the Coen Brothers or the Koch Brothers, although probably closer in estimation to, you know, depending on what a fan you are of the Koch Brothers, I think people might more equate them with those than the Coen Brothers.
This week, maybe. Yeah.
Yes. Even though the Coen Brothers are more entertainment oriented, the Fine Brothers are folks who have brought you over the years various children react to iPods kind of videos. Old people react to fill in the blank.
It's basically kids say the darndest thing on YouTube.
Yes. So. Great way to put it. So they have a brand that they've built up over the years of doing these, we're showing reactions of groups of people to interesting things, and the reactions are interesting in their own right. And they've been chugging along and doing just great, building up a large YouTube following until this last week, where they decided to, it looks like they were trying to do something that was going to help them from a marketing standpoint. And instead, it had just the opposite result. the internet interpreted their statement to be was something along the lines of, we have registered all kinds of trademarks in the word React, and fill in the blank, reacts to. And we're going to start enforcing those. We've been enforcing those already. And in order to prevent our enforcing them against you, you might want to think about licensing our format from us. So I am paraphrasing, but they said it pretty clumsily. And the internet kind of imploded on them. And they've had to backpedal and say, no, we're not going to be pursuing that strategy. Sorry, our bad. Actually, there's an interesting article. I don't know if Mike Masnick wrote it. I can't remember that right now off the top of my head or not, but it's over at Tech Dirt, talking about how, you know, if you give these guys the benefit of the doubt and you actually, yeah, Mike did write this. You actually look through the details and the FAQs, et cetera, et cetera. What they were doing was not necessarily as evil as everyone made it out to be, and that actually they were perhaps attempting to give people a platform to make similar videos and sort of piggyback off the success of the Fine Brothers and have everyone share the revenue of that. So that is another way of looking at what went on here. But it doesn't look like they will be pursuing this strategy at all, given the backlash that they have been subjected to. Emery, yeah. What do you make of all this?
I mean, I thought my immediate takeaway was just this seems really actually similar to the discussion we had about Monster Cat a couple weeks ago. You know, this is another sort of the package was presented to users as just nauseatingly sweet. Oh, this is the next big thing, and we have a great announcement to you, and this is going to let users use our content. But the devil is in the details. I'm not sure. I get where Mike Masnick is coming from with the idea that it's, you know, in theory, this could be a good platform, a good idea to allow YouTubers to let other people sort of build a community around their brand and monetize similar videos. The problem is that, first of all, if the Fine Brothers have a long history of overreacting, sicking their fans on other groups of people that they think are already sort of infringing on their brand beforehand. They made some news, some controversy when Ellen DeGeneres sort of had a similar style of kids react showcase on her show. They effectively sicked their fans on her, and that was a little unsettling, especially because, as we said, you know, this is Bill Cosby was doing this before these kids were born.
Right.
You know, the idea of having kids react to X, Y, Z or whatever is not a novel idea. Reaction videos have been on the internet since forever. So it's not really clear what exactly where their trademark argument is coming from here. The week past or the week since their announcement before they backpedaled, they did already start issuing takedown notices specifically for trademark violations on other YouTubers, small YouTubers. And it was really just not a good direction for them to go in. Immediately after their announcement, Ryan Morrison, who's been a guest on here before with us, Reddit's video game lawyer, had a thread that went to the front page very, very quickly, where he volunteered his own time to do to challenge this trademark, which was very generous of him. And I think that got some news and got some buzz and probably contributed significantly to them deciding to backpedal. I can, again, I see where Mike Masnick is coming from, but these people are probably the last YouTubers that deserve to be creating a unique community brand, if that's what it is. Their content was really just set up a camera in front of some kids, let's show them something and watch how they react. It was done before them and it'll be done after them. But it's good to see that, you know, there was righteous internet indignation over this. You know, every now and then, the cynical side of me is concerned that I'm the only one on the internet that cares about IP rights. And every now and then it's good that there's some righteous fury about these kind of issues. So it was an interesting, entertaining week.
Yeah. And I think you're correct that there is more recognition. There's not a ton of education and nuanced knowledge around how things like this work, but there's definitely more attention paid to, hey, you know, that doesn't sound right. And seems to me like they've got the law wrong here. And then, you know, it's left to folks like Ryan Morrison and other lawyers to come in and say, yeah, I think they've got the law wrong here too. And I'm going to get behind that if necessary with the Patent and Trademark Office. Here, let me read you what Mike wrote in his article that I thought was interesting. Again, he's very much trying to put himself in their shoes and give them the benefit of the doubt. I would add to this that they needed to have better legal representation before they decided to launch this idea. That would have gone a long way toward salvaging this debacle for them. But with this goal in mind, it seems like they could have done this in a much better way had they gotten some good strategy help on the front end. Here's what Mike says. They know that lots of people make similar reaction videos, and a lot of those people are their fans. But rather than shut them down and rather than demand big licensing fees, they created this somewhat unique program where they're giving a license to anyone who wants it. And with that license, you get a variety of benefits, including graphic elements and, importantly, the ability to have the Fine Brothers help promote and monetize your videos. They take a cut, looks like a pretty small percentage, actually, but that should be worth it for many people who probably wouldn't have many opportunities to monetize the videos by themselves. So I think a couple of important points there is that although they probably overinterpreted what their own legal rights were, there probably are some legal rights that they have built up from making these videos, whether it's a copyright in the graphics or a particular kind of format, the graphics coupled with music, coupled with, you know, there's probably a way to make a valid copyright claim that if someone copied them precisely, they'd be in good shape to complain about it. So I think they probably did overreach, but kudos to them at least for trying something new in a partnership kind of way rather than just, okay, we're going to DMCA take down anybody who looks like us and we're going to enforce these trademarks that we've registered. Do you agree with me at all, Emery?
Yeah, I mean, in part and no, also. I think that they actually did try to enforce their trademarks on anyone, regardless of, you know, mm-hmm. whether they were even parodying them or reacting to their reaction. I think that one of the videos they took down was this kid YouTuber who had like less than 1,000 subscribers, who had a video with a couple hundred views on it that was him reacting to the Fine Brothers. and they had that taken down. And it's just that's the kind of thing that, you know, in the week when everyone is just now hearing about this and everyone is very angry about this, that's just not the kind of thing you do. It's again, the Streisand effect. And it just drew attention to, you know, again, could this be done better by different people? I do not doubt it. I think that personally, I'm a little reticent on the idea of building communities that are tied to platforms like YouTube. But clearly the platforms are there and that's where people are using it. So if there are, interesting, innovative licensing ideas out there, strategies, you know, I'm all for hearing them. It's just, again, these people maybe poison the well, to be honest. There's a follow-up article by Mike the day after he published this one that says that, you know, had it not been them, hopefully, you know, this could be good, but clearly these guys were not the ones to do this correctly.
Right. And I think there's a great object lesson in all of this that, yes, there's room for creative partnerships with your fans as you develop a big internet brand, but you really need to be running those strategies by people who aren't in the entertainment industry. I think, or not so constrained by the dynamics of the entertainment industry, which is another point that Mike uses, that they're throwing around terms like licensing and formats, which mean one thing in Hollywood and another thing to the world at large. And
exactly. And the way they announced it was so infuriating. Right. It was I hate to like play on it, but like the Silicon Valley, you know, prototype of just the dude bro that's like super excited about the community that they're building, and this is going to be such a great opportunity for everyone. And it's like, no, it's not. This is a lousy opportunity. The terms that you've agreed on are awful for us, but didn't stop them from presenting it with a sickly veneer.
Right. Exactly. And we're going to strip out all your metadata with the help of Joe Mornin, kind of thing. Because, yes, because what you're presenting as good for us is really good for you.
Yeah. And I think something that is a trend that is really disturbing is the misrepresentation of these sort of legal terms in ways that paint the picture that it's, you know, beneficial to you, but it's really not. It's almost goes back to the privacy policy notice problem. You know, it's not that they're just providing the bare minimum amount of notice put in the most positive light. But it's not really indicative of the actual rights that they're getting.
Yep, I think that's well said. All right, well, we will continue to keep an eye on the Fine Brothers and what winds up happening with their plan, if anything. But moving on, we would not be able to do a show without letting you know that some other selfie animals have come to the fore, in addition to Naruto the macaque, which I'm sure everyone is familiar with and is probably sick to death of seeing Naruto's photos crop up on This Week in Law. But we can not avoid talking about the IP ramifications of animals taking pictures of themselves. We have a couple of good examples of this week. Actually, the horse did not take the picture of itself. In the UK, however, some folks were wandering down the country lane in their delightful town. They stumbled across a horse in a pasture. Dad and son, looks like, David Bellis and his 3-year-old son, Jacob. Somebody took a picture of the dad and son, or maybe it's the dad holding up the camera, taking a selfie of the two of them. And the horse is behind, giving all kinds of great horse teeth. They submitted this epic photobomb picture to a holiday site, a travel site that was giving away a vacation for the best picture. It was called the Made Me Smile competition. And they won a 2,000-pound holiday main prize for this picture. So that's all well and good until the owner of the horse comes in and begins making noises that somehow they should have been contacted or cut in on this, that there was no permission given to use the image of their horse to submit to this competition. So it seems to be what we would in the U.S. Call a name and likeness, a right of publicity sort of argument that the horse's owners are making here, that somehow they or the horse have rights that were infringed by this photographer and his son. Much like the Fine Brothers trademark arguments, I don't think there's much legal water to the horse owner's contentions here. Do you, Emery?
No, I don't. I'm not as familiar with European IP. I know that they sort of tend to value the rights from the author that spring forth from the author a little more than we do. But yeah, this sounds like, if anything, it's some, like, they're trying to claim a name, like a rights of publicity on the name and likeness of the horse. It's very odd. I almost think that this is, this goes back to the monkey selfie, because this is an issue where there's just enough publicity for people to become aware that there's such a thing as, rights or issues concerning pictures that animals are taking by themselves. And this person conflated that news to think that maybe he has some right in photographs taken by others of his animal, which is frankly not true. So, you know, the father took this photograph on a public street. So it sounds pretty cut and dry to me.
So this horse is not famous in its own right before this picture, although the owners of the horse have taught the horse to stick out its tongue like this. So it constantly makes this funny face, apparently. But the horse is not Grumpy Cat. If Grumpy Cat had been along the side of the road and the father and son had paused to take a selfie, would we be having a different conversation because Grumpy Cat has more notoriety?
Yeah, I think we might have. That's interesting. I hadn't thought about that. Yeah. Had this been an internet famous horse, would we be, talking about a different story?
Yeah, I don't know. Again, you've got an animal in a public place which doesn't have its own rights, but I'm sure that, for the owners of Lil Bub and Grumpy Cat and the other internet famous animals out there, I'm sure they take every step they can to protect the image and likeness of those beasts.
Again, it sounds like all sorts of complicated legal issues wrapped up in that. Yeah.
Yes. I'm going to put a note in your IP profs box so that you can look forward to this on a final coming soon. Of course, the horse is not the only animal in the news this week. Manny the cat is actually taking selfies of himself. And this is just the cutest dang thing I've ever seen. Apparently, the cat likes to bat at GoPro cameras. And when it does, it trips the shutter and it takes pictures of itself. So we have Manny has an Instagram account, Your Mom, YOREMAHM. They're posting these GoPros of Manny there. So again, here we're more in the monkey selfie realm where, I don't think PETA is going to step in and try and represent Manny, but you never know. What do you think?
I think PETA was slapped down last time they tried to, but again, actually, yes. I think that, if I had to guess, that I don't think that there's a sort of, shutter if swapped detection on GoPro cameras. I think that the way this is working is that he probably has a GoPro on like a stick and he points it out towards the cat and the cat reaches up and bats it. It's a great effect. It's made for Tumblr for sure. and if the cat was actually tripping the shutter, then I think we'd have a more interesting discussion. But yeah, this is...
So you think there's some sort of automatic... switch on a stick that the cat is hitting, not the camera
I think it's probably a GoPro video on a GoPro stick, and he just points it at the animals, and the cat goes, "Oh, hey," and gets the perfect freeze frame.
Yes. Well, on a GoPro they have the you don't need a freeze frame if you put it on constant. Just take a stream of pictures.
But in any case, that would be the user initiating burst mode. So I think that copyright would probably still be vested in the photographer.
Right.
Thankfully.
Yes. Oh, that's so good. no copyright issues have arisen involving Manny that we know of, but we're waiting with bated cat chow breath to arise.
Manny into a brand, though, if he builds Manny into give Manny his own Instagram, his own Tumblr, build it into a brand, maybe sell a Manny branded selfie stick for animals. then we can start talking. We'll couch this for the next 6 months, then come back to it later.
We have so many new product launches that are coming out of this episode. I love it. All right. Let's talk about fonts for a minute and My Little Pony and how fonts can come and bite you in the ponytail. What happened here to Hasbro, Emery?
So I found this sort of by chance and then dove into the rabbit hole. It is, you know, there's that podcast, Surprisingly Awesome. This is Surprisingly Awesome. So Hasbro's My Little Pony has in the past been pretty aggressive about, and I'm speaking from my research here, so I might be incorrect here, but Hasbro, from what I understand, has been pretty aggressive about shutting down unauthorized fan remakes or, you know, not fan fiction, but use of their own IP, which is ironic because apparently they have been using the font for My Little Pony's title. They were unauthorized use of it. So that font has been is owned by a man that is pulling up the article now that is issuing a lawsuit against Hasbro for unauthorized use of the font Generation B, which is the font used in the title for My Little Pony. Now, that in and of itself is sort of a great karmic article. It makes you feel warm and fuzzy that, you know, corporations that try to shut down users are getting their own comeuppance. But the plot thickens. So first, there's really two interesting issues here. First is whether or not fonts are copyrightable, which is not immediately clear. Traditionally, typefaces are not copyrightable, according to the Compendium of U.S. Copyright Office Practices, 3rd edition. Generally, typefaces, type fonts, lettering, calligraphy, and typographic ornamentation are not registerable. The fonts that are registerable under copyright are the, if there are any sort of artistic serifs, or to the extent that the font in itself has been you know, artistically enhanced, those artistic additions might be copyrightable. But because it's just a typeface, they say that that's simply a form before, not an expression, and so not copyrightable. But fonts are not typefaces. Fonts actually refer to the software package that contains the typeface. So you can sue under copyright for misuse of fonts because it's a licensing issue. The fonts are copyrightable, the typefaces are not. It's all very interesting. There's a new media rights article that my friend Gabe Estrada wrote up. I think that we have in the show notes as well. So yes, they are copyrightable, so this can go forward. But the other interesting side of this story is that the fan community has known that this has been copyrighted for a long time. So one of the reasons that Hasbro has sent takedown notices to fan fan art for My Little Pony is that it misuses the font, which is ironic, obviously.
Which they have no rights to and haven't licensed.
Exactly. So there's another fan-made font called Celestia Medium Redux. It's a fan-made font meant to emulate the My Little Pony font because, in case you weren't aware, by the way, there is a very strong community of My Little Pony fans on the internet, and they like to make fan modifications and fan art. And this font, Celestia Medium Redux, was created in part because they were getting takedown notices on the font. So they rasterized it, and someone released this on the internet anonymously. And people have been using that because, again, remember, it's the font itself, the software package itself, that's copyrightable under a software license, not the underlying typeface. So that's just an interesting element that, you know, this is this is something that Hasbro has been trying to shut down, even though they didn't have the rights to do so before. The fans have already responded, and now finally the actual copyright owner of the font is coming after Hasbro themselves. So it's a very interesting copyright mess of a story this week.
In IRC, strengths is saying, say it. Say bronies. All right, we've said it.
I'm not going to say it.
We're not afraid to say bronies.
It says, don't say bronies.
Yeah, It's a fascinating story, and it takes us full circle back to Steve Jobs at Reed College and the fonts that
Jobs was a brony. You heard it here first. What? I'm sorry.
No, continue. Jobs wasn't a brony that I know of. Who knows? He was obsessed with fonts, however. I do not know. My memory does not cast back far enough to be aware of whether Apple had font issues when it released its first word processor that was one of the first to font IP issues to allow you to pick a font and change your fonts.
Something to dig into.
Yeah, they may well have had to license them. All righty. I think we'll make Bite You in the Ponytail our second passphrase for this episode of This Week in Law for MCLE purposes. And we'll go ahead and thank our second sponsor for this episode as well before we move on to the fun with the DMCA that I promised you. Our second sponsor for this episode is PillPack. PillPack is a full-service pharmacy that takes care of everything for you. They pre-sort and deliver your medications and vitamins in these easy-to-tear packets, labeled with the date and time for each dose, so you no longer need that Monday through Sunday pill box if you're somebody who uses those. On the last show, I showed you all the pills I had packed for the trip I took last week. Basically, I just dump all my travel supplies into a Zippy. This is a much better way to approach that problem. Everything, little blister packs of the pills that you're supposed to take at certain times. You can see that these are labeled with actual times of day. So you know what you're supposed to take, you know when you're supposed to take it. You're not confusing one medication with another. It's organized and it incorporates, this is so important, I think, in today's day and age, and shows you that PillPack is not just thinking in the past. They're recognizing how people actually consume the things that they take for their health today. And that is, you have a bunch of things that are not prescribed for you that you take because they're good for you or you feel like they're helpful for you. And you have things that are prescribed for you that you take because your doctor has told you to. But the thing is, they're all pills. So it's real easy to get them confused. And PillPack deals with that quite nicely. If you give them your prescriptions, you sign up on their site so that they're filling your prescriptions for you. You can also tell them the supplements that you take, and they'll very nicely organize it in these nice little plastic containers so that you're taking the right thing at the right time on the right day. As someone who has passed the age of 50, this is a very important thing and gets even more important as we advance in our years. Their pharmacists are available 24/7 from the privacy of your own home, so you no longer need to have those awkward pharmacy encounters. And they proactively call your doctor for you to manage all your refills so you don't run out. Very important. There's no extra cost beyond your standard copays. Shipping is always free. It's compatible with most major insurance plans, including most forms of Medicare Part D. When you sign up for PillPack, they make sure that your insurance is compatible before they transfer any of your medications over. Switching is easy. Sign up on their secure site, and they take care of everything for you. It's been recognized by Time Magazine as a top 25 invention. Jill Duffy gave it a great review in PC Magazine. There's also a PillPack medication reminder app for the iPhone and Apple Watch. So even if you're someone who doesn't have a lot of prescriptions, maybe just one or two, I think this makes a ton of sense if you also take vitamins and supplements of other kind to get them all organized and ready for you. PillPack is medication simplified. You won't believe how much easier and more convenient it is until you've tried it. And I want you to try it. Here's what you do. Visit pillpack.com/twit to sign up now. Their site is beautiful and it only takes 5 minutes to sign up. When you use our link and transfer your prescriptions to PillPack, you'll get a credit for $20 worth of vitamins and other over-the-counters. That's pillpack.com/twit, T-W-I-T. Thank you so much, PillPack, for making life so much more organized and portable, and for your support of This Week in Law. All right, I promised you the DMCA. Let's talk about that now. Couple of DMCA stories for us to touch on this week. Weirdwatch.com is a site from the MPAA, which attempts to grapple with the fact that there are lots of legal alternatives for watching copyrighted material out there. You don't have to torrent everything. The MPAA wants you to know this and wants to be able to direct you to where you can legally download or stream whatever your heart desires. So they also recognize that it's not easy to find the stuff, that if you're a subscriber to one service and the program you'd like to watch is not there, you might not know where else to look. So the MPAA is trying to address that for you. Unfortunately, WhereToWatch.com has itself been the victim of what many other sites have also been the victim of, the fact that Hollywood rights holders are prone to outsourcing their DMCA takedowns to third-party services that scour the web and try and find links to what they believe are unauthorized copies of copyrighted material. So the MPAA itself has been hit with studio-oriented takedowns designed to have them remove links from their own WhereToWatch.com site. So the irony fairly drips from this one. Emery, is there anything you would tell the MPAA about how they can avoid this?
Oh, man. I mean, I think that the MPAA should take notes. You know, on the one hand, as strongly as they are lobbying for changes to the DMCA that, you know, they've been pushing for notice and takedown provisions. So not only they would like that websites not only are required to take down content when they receive a DMCA takedown, they would like websites to basically have the obligation of making sure the content stays down once it's taken down. This would put a huge burden on business owners, website owners, users, content creators. And it really, the MPAA has been basing a lot of this argument on the idea that this isn't a practice that is abused, or at least they ignore the fact that the system is abused. It's great that events like this, where their own service got taken down, really clearly show that the system is abused, and the idea that we should be giving DMCA takedowns more power is pretty terrifying. You know, this entire purpose of this website was to try to combat piracy, but of course the issue is that DMCA takedowns are so easy to send out that Hollywood uses intermediaries to send out bulk takedown notices using software automation sometimes, and it looks like their website got sort of scooped up in the net of these bulk takedown notices. So shooting themselves in the foot, but I hope that the advocates remember this and, you know, shove this in their face come next decision period, because that would be great.
Right. I think we've mentioned on at least one recent show of This Week in Law that the Copyright Office is asking for comments on the DMCA, on how it should be reformed or tweaked. And as Emery points out, one way that the entertainment industry would like to see it changed is for a notice and stay down provision to be added to the law, so that once you've been notified once that this infringing item was on your site, you are obligated to make sure that it stays off your site. And although that does involve a ton of burden, you know, in a case like YouTube or another intermediary site that hosts millions and millions of videos, it might actually be impossible to do that kind of policing. But Reverb Mike is pointing out in IRC, and it's true, that you can still pretty readily, despite all the content ID and the automated takedown notices that YouTube is constantly hit with, you can still find full-length movies on YouTube. So do you see any sort of light at the end of this tunnel, Emery?
I mean, I don't know. It's tough to say. YouTube is obviously, and Google is obviously getting very, very good at their content ID, or at least they're getting better with their content ID. I noticed that what you see frequently on YouTube are pitch changed videos. So they'll take a movie or a TV show and then drop the pitch a couple decibels or raise it a couple decibels to try to skirt around that content ID. I can only assume that Google's super intelligent algorithms are going to be picking up on that eventually. But yeah, this is one of the real underlying problems, I think, with the DMCA is that it's almost ignoring the idea that you can have these huge giant players on the internet. So when you what do you do when you have a service that not only do they get millions of takedown requests every day, but they also have millions of videos up on their website, and certainly a considerable, or at least a percent of those, are probably infringing. It's a balancing act that I don't think the DMCA does a very good job of balancing right now. But I do think that pushing for heavier, notice and stay down provisions is not the way to go. DMCA takedown notice process is already fairly bizarre, I think. I think that Art Neal has said it before, but I don't think that I can think of any other process by which a business or individual can simply send a letter and have something extrajudicially taken off of the internet. That's really what the companies are obligated to do that if they want to fit into the DMCA. So right. I don't really know what the solution is right now.
Every takedown notice is its own little ex parte application.
It's even more than an ex parte because you don't have to, it's not even you and the judge. It's just a letter. It's just a letter that says, hey, this is ours, take it down, and they have to. So it's very, very bizarre.
It is. And now I can't get out of my head, and I'm sure there is a market for this. Pitch changed movies are such a great, great notion. Can you imagine the Alvin and the Chipmunks? The Alvin and the Chipmunks audio version of Gone with the Wind, for example.
I'm someone that listens exclusively to podcasts I listen to way too many podcasts, and I can only get through my podcast list by listening to them at 1.5 speed or, something like that. So I'm used to pitch changes. I think I can probably be okay with it, but it is very bizarre.
Well, yeah, and I'm sure, and here I'm going to tuck this in your IP law professor's box right after my last note, that an exam should involve a pitch changed video where it's actually supposed to be comedy or parody or commentary.
Yeah. Is that a transformation?
Yes, exactly. You could definitely envision that. Oh, all right. Let's talk about this Torrent Freak piece, and we've been talking about a lot of startup ideas on the show today. Here's a good one. Use the DMCA as a marketing tool. What is Musit doing exactly here, Emery?
Okay, so I was talking about this with you before the show. I've dived through Musit's website, their terms of use, their privacy policy, their blog, and I think that honestly the Torrent Freak article was the most informative as far as grokking what they're doing. But as far as I can understand it, Musit is a service. It's a big data service, and they use they track just like a lot of watchdog agencies out there. They track online downloads, torrent downloads, and what they do is they use this data to sort of build geo maps of where artists' works are being downloaded, where musicians' works are being downloaded, and their business model is then to take that data and give it or sell it to artists, but not so that they can ostensibly not so they can send takedown notices, but instead so that they can connect and engage with their fans. Trying to find the CEO, Tommy Funderburk. Had previously had a service like this where they used – it was very similar where they used – they tracked online downloads and then simply turned that information over to artists to allow them to more easily send DMCA takedowns. This apparently, according to them, they have struck the word pirates or piracy from their vernacular and instead refer to them as P2P or fans or customers, fans, not foes. And I think that's a really interesting approach. I am a little concerned, though, because as you said, the company is using DMCA takedowns or DMCA notices, at least, as a means to connect artists and fans, which to me sounds like pairing DMCA notices with spam, which sounds like two things that users don't want to receive.
That's right. So is Musit monitoring the DMCA notices that others are sending, or is it sending them out itself?
So as I understand it, I don't know a way of Musit to monitor the DMCA notices that are being sent out. I think that what they're doing is they're monitoring the traffic. Now, it's easier for them to monitor torrent traffic because they can just have a box that's seeding it or tracking that information. But I think that they're giving that data away to artists, but working like within their platform is an easy way for artists to then additionally, in addition to connecting with artists and with fans and knowing where your fans are and knowing, you know, where to go to tour, it does allow artists to send DMCA notices and include, quote, a marketing message in the notices. According to the CEO, he says, as long as it's friendly, artists can send any type of messages they want. So the idea being that an artist would find that there's a whole community of people downloading their work in Timbuktu. And so not only would they then know to tour to Timbuktu, they know that there's a market there, but they can also send DMCA notices that say, by the way, I'm coming to tour here. Or by the way, you know, here's a coupon for my next CD that's dropping. So on the one hand, you know, I think that shifting the narrative to, you know, fans not pirates, fans not foes is admirable and great. I do worry that the idea of using DMCA notices as a form of advertising is that sounds like it's doomed for failure, frankly. Just I can't imagine two things that people want less, you know.
This is the next Fine Brothers debacle, is when they actually start sending out DMCA notices and some kind of, hey, you know, you really need to be following this band. Subscribe here.
Yeah. And, you know, it's I characterize it to you as it feels bizarre. I'm not sure. Like, I totally understand the idea of using the geo information to target advertising. I totally do not understand why they thought it was a good idea to bundle DMCA notices with that. Unless, and here's my cynical hat coming on, unless that's really their goal, you know, because remember, he had, you know, an identical service beforehand where the express purpose was to facilitate DMCA notices being sent out.
Right.
So whether or not this is really embracing fans, not foes, or just nominally saying they are, you know, I think it remains to be seen. So just like Monster Cat, just like so many other things, there's some sort of interesting business models coming out here, but I'm really, really hoping they're not going to be evil. So fingers crossed.
Tommy Funderburk, what a great name. We'll have to follow along with Musit and see if they're able to navigate these waters without getting themselves in internet hot water. It sounds like they're at least on the verge of that. There is a patent story that I'd like us to discuss before we go ahead and wrap the show. So let's get to that.
We need some bed music specifically for animal selfies, by the way. I'm not sure if we can still get in touch with the fan that made those bed musics before, but selfie animal bed music for next show, please.
Okay. We'll put it on the list. Selfie animal music. The EFF does this great thing where it highlights a stupid patent each month. This month's is sharing your hard copy documents, but on a social network. So I actually was inspired to put this in the show by Joe Mornin sharing his law school notes on GitHub. Those, as he described, are not hard copies, but actually a super cool machine readable digital format. But U.S. patent number 9,240,000 is called Social Network for Enabling the Physical Sharing of Documents. And this is more about scanning pieces of paper and sharing them on social networks and attempting, well, they have been granted a patent in that. This is just really one of those. The EFF does a great job of trying to call out when something seems particularly ridiculous. And they've actually given this one the award for Stupid Patent of the Month. And I think it's well-deserved. What do you think, Emery?
Yeah, I mean, I agree with EFF here and you. It's it's just, you know, goes back to the underlying problem with patents, and that it's very, you know, you can write a 5-page patent application with very complex obfuscating language that effectively is, here's a patent on how to scan a document and email it. So it doesn't, you know, I'm not seeing the real underlying technology that they're adding here. You know, every time one of these issues comes up, I'm just reminded of the patent issue. I think Twill talked about it last year, you know, patent for novel way of swinging on swing set given to 11-year-old son of patent attorney. You know, it's just, this
one is Xerox who got this patent. I don't know if that makes a difference when a patent application is presented to the patent office, if it's a company
like
Xerox.
When I was initially reading this, I wasn't sure if it was some kind of DRM technology, like maybe Xerox is trying to create a secure way of sharing documents that has, you know, automatically self-destructs or something. I mean, I don't think that's very clear. But yeah, it's I think well-deserved the Stupid Patent of the Month award.
Yeah, absolutely. And the language of the patent is, you know, very obscure. If you want to get into it, it is difficult to figure out what it is they're trying to patent here. But all of that is available at the Deep Links.
We need machine-readable patents. See? We had machine-readable patents. Our software could just go through this and fix the problems with the patent industry or the patent office. Say, wait a minute. This is exactly the same as what we've already got. So
yes,
work on that, Joe.
That would be helpful. Joe, I hope you're listening to the rest of the show. You can find this over at the Deep Links blog at the Electronic Frontier Foundation if you're interested in Xerox possibly coming after you when you scan that ancient letter of yours and post it to Facebook. All right. I think we are down to our resource and tip of the week. Our resource is harkening back to our last episode of This Week in Law when we had Professor Goldman on the show. Every year, he does a top 10 internet law developments rundown. So he's finished his one for 2015. It's very interesting to go back and look at these year by year. He's been doing them for quite some time. I know his blog just celebrated its 10-year anniversary. I don't know if he's been doing them that entire time, but really interesting to go back and see what the hot issues were as the years go by. Some of those featured on his list for 2015 are cars as computers, the FTC as privacy and security enforcer, high stakes copyright battles seem to come up every year. Who is an employee online? The distinction between employees and independent contractors as we continue to develop and build out the sharing economy. So really interesting to look back at the prior year. And then as this year goes on, see how these issues continue to play out or whether others come along and supplant them. Any thoughts on this before we go to our tip of the week, Emery?
No, I don't have any. I was reviewing that article when we had Eric on the show a couple weeks ago. And if you missed that, Twill listeners, go back and check it out. It's a great show.
Yep, episode 334. All right, our tip of the week has to do with the Super Bowl this Sunday. And if you are a Bay Area person and we're hoping to just kind of, you know, because there are a lot of drones around the Bay Area, whether you're down in the Santa Clara area where the Super Bowl is taking place or further up the coast, you're going to want to keep your drones away from the Super Bowl at least 37 miles. That is the air radius around the Super Bowl, and it includes drones. Ian Greger is an official at the FAA, and he lets us know that if you violate that for an individual, you can face up to $1,100 per violation, up to $27,500 for businesses, And you could face also criminal charges if you violate the temporary flight restriction.
So bear that in mind.
That is crazy, right?
That 37 miles.
37 miles seems excessive. Yes, it's quite a long distance.
I would think you could live.
If I were living 3 miles away from the Super Bowl venue and a frequent drone user, I'd be rather upset about this. But maybe maybe it's just you know, the government telling us take the afternoon off from droning. it's a good idea.
If we want to talk a little policy, I think it's a little alarming that something like the Super Bowl can suddenly shut down drone airspace for 37 miles just all of a sudden. It's a little weird. I'm not sure how I feel about that.
Well, and if you've been paying attention to the headlines around this at all, what a lot of media outlets seized on, and of course this is true whether the Super Bowl is going on or not in any U.S. airspace, if there is an aircraft, including a drone, that the government decides is an imminent security threat, they can shoot that puppy out of the sky. A lot of the headlines about this were not focusing on the fines or the scope of the air radius around the Coliseum, but on the deadly force aspect that, hey, you don't want to put your drone over the Super Bowl because deadly force could be used if you're an imminent threat. I think becoming an imminent threat is, you know, when it's happening, there's, you know, weaponry involved or the threat of harm or explosion. That you should not take that as a legal definition by any means, but it's sort of one of those, you know it when you see it things, and I'm sure that that law enforcement could define it better. But really the interesting part here is the fines that could be imposed on the hapless person who wants to get some footage of the Super Bowl, and the fact that even if you had a drone that had a really, really good telephoto lens, you know, it almost feels like there's an IP overlay to this, right? Because if you could be safely a couple of miles away, or, you know, maybe not a couple of miles away, but safely far from the stadium so that you're not interfering with anybody's enjoyment of the game, but it's close enough to take footage, that seems to be something that strikes me as something the NFL would want to prevent. So,
and you know, the idea that copyright interests could leak over to the FAA and shut down airspace is something that, frankly, wouldn't be very surprised to hear. And this kind of unilateral, just 37 miles air, it's just alarming, to be honest. It sounds a little alarming.
As far as terrorist targets in the U.S. go on Sunday, this has got to be the big one, right? So I can see why there's a security concern. And perhaps the 37-mile radius has to do with that imminent threat notion that, you know, if we're going to have any drones, even within shouting distance of the Super Bowl, that's not something we want to deal with.
Yeah. Yeah, I also heard that San Francisco, if you're riding public transit right now today or this weekend, you can expect to have your bags searched, even if you're not heading to Santa Clara, if you're just in San Francisco, which is, again, I mean, I guess that's something that we have to be okay with. It's disheartening.
It is indeed. All right. But our tip to you is to ground your drones
on Sunday
if you're
home
in the Bay Area. Yeah, keep them at home and keep them far from the stadium. All right. That is the end of this episode of This Week in Law. We're so glad that you've been able to join us. We do this show every Friday at 11 o'clock Pacific time, 1800 UTC, where you can log on at twit.tv and join us live. We hope that you can do that. It's fun to have a live audience for the show. We love the people who join us in our IRC channel that's available at irc.twit.tv and play along during the show. If you can't do that, don't worry about it at all. In fact, we're so glad to have you join us. whenever, wherever it works for you, to speed up the audio and listen to the podcast, among the many that you might be consuming. You can go to the twit.tv/twill site, and there are all kinds of ways to subscribe to and enjoy the show that are listed out for you there. We have a YouTube site, youtube.com/thisweekinlaw. And it's available on iTunes and all manner of other devices. The Roku is a nice way to go if you like to kick back and watch us in high definition glory in your living room. That's a wonderful way to do it. Of course, Apple TVs will do that too, since the show's in iTunes. Anyway, however you join us, we're just thrilled that you do. We're so grateful for the people that watch this show week in and week out. And if you've just tuned in, we hope you'd enjoy it. And let us know. Let us know how we're doing. Give us a review in iTunes. That definitely helps us have feedback as to whether we're covering the things that people are interested in. Another thing that helps is if you get in touch with us and just let us know directly. So you can email me. I'm denise@twit.tv. Let us know about the topics that you're interested in, if you appreciated a certain discussion or guest that we had, if you'd like to see us expand on things. We'd love to hear that from you. We'd love also your topic suggestions, guest suggestions, anything that we can do to make the show more fun and interesting for you, because, you know, we design it around what floats our boat, and we'd love to do the same for you as well, especially folks that have been with us for so long. We've been almost doing the show for 10 years now, which just boggles my mind. I know. This is our 10-year year, 2016. When we get toward the end of the year, we'll let you know when that anniversary happens. But in the meantime, we're just thrilled to have you come back each week. We hope that you will next week. We will see you then on This Week in Law. Emery, thank you so much for being here with me today.
As always, thanks for having me. It's been a lot of fun.
All right. See you next week. Take care, everyone.